This is Dennis Slattery, April 8th, 2005. Pilgrimage, tape one of two.
This group is becoming more and more interesting as people come in the door. Connie, I want to thank you. I want to thank Shirley for your gracious introduction. And I want to thank all of you who I bet worked all week to buy the groceries and to pay the mortgage, and here you are on a Friday night. It means a great deal to me that you have given over some of your precious free time to be here tonight. You know, I have been working on this talk for probably, I don't know, the last 6 or 7 weeks. I've reached that point in my life where the anxiety level isn't what it used to be, and oftentimes I find myself coming up in front of a group really not sure of what I'm going to say. Now, I have my script, but I'm also feeling into you to see who's in the room to decide rhetorically, you know, which way I ought to move, because you carry that energy and I can feel it. And I feel your welcoming energy, so I feel really quite relaxed. I hope you will allow me to share some of my writing from Grace in the Desert. The original manuscript was 140,000 words. This is 70,000. So one of every two pages. Actually, I ought to just publish the other book and just have Grace revisited. Yeah. You know, when I published the Wounded Body book, SUNY Press made me jettison or perform major surgery on 6 chapters, which sit at home in a file, and somebody said, well, why don't you just do Wounds 2? So I think I have 2 other books coming out, but I've got to change the title enough so that maybe somebody would buy one or the other of them. But I'm just, as I continue to teach literature and continue to be influenced by the thinking of Joseph Campbell, who I'm teaching the course for the second year in a row exclusively on his work, I'm becoming more and more fascinated. And parenthetically, I think it has everything to do with having crossed the 6-0 threshold last October. Let me tell you, if you're not there yet, not at 60. 40 is a piece of cake. It's not even a speed bump. 50, you get serious. 60, everything changes. Temporality, history, memory, the body. We have a granddaughter. All of that puts one in a continuum that I've never felt prior to this time in my life. And so I am more than willing to be the first one to admit how little I know. But I'm more and more fascinated by what I don't know. And it's a whole shift in the way I teach, and I think it's a whole shift in the way that I learn. And I want to share with you some passages from Grace in the Desert, and to tell you now that, here, let me tell you the story. I know I'm not the only one in the room who realizes how deadly and fatal can be bookstores. So I found myself in Santa Barbara in 1997, with 20 minutes to spare, which is deadly. You've got to keep your schedule completely filled. Or, like Oedipus, that fate will come at you, and it comes at you from behind. And I know you, but I can't remember your name. Great. Good to see you. It's so wonderful to see so many of my students and so many faces that I don't know. I went into a bookstore. I was drifting over to the travel section, a deadly place to be. I pulled a book on Ireland off the shelf, and a book to the left of it came with it and landed on my right toe. Now, some of you Jungians can talk about the right side and the left side. And I'm all ears on how I should read this. And it was volume one of a two-volume series called Sanctuaries, a guide to monasteries and retreat centers in the Western United States. And the volume right next to it was volume two, Guide to Retreat Centers and Monasteries in the Eastern Half of the U.S. I pulled it off the shelf and discovered inside maybe 120 different monasteries and retreat centers written up. Now, at this point in my life, I was 30 years in the classroom, never a sabbatical. It's one of the shadow sides in academe when you move around, because you always move to the bottom of the totem pole. So without thinking, but being thought, I was told, spend the sabbatical moving through monasteries, retreat centers, Zen Buddhist centers. And it was a voice of destiny itself. So for about 2.5 months, I bought both volumes. For 2.5 months, I simply flipped through. Oh, I've got some competition. Oh, we okay? Yeah. I flipped through until I heard this one. Wrote it down. Decided to stay on the western half of the United States. Pretty soon I had a list of 17 monasteries. Now this is all taking place from a level that wasn't logos directed. And then I began calls. So I ritualized this process. And the ones that had no room, those were the places I wasn't supposed to go to. The places that said, yes, you can go on those dates, were the places that I was to show up at, either to, I can say this to you, I couldn't say it, could I say it on Oprah? Oh, that would be the day. Oh, that's some fantasy, put that aside. I knew that I had to go there to say something to someone or be told something by someone. And every single place I visited, I met people who needed something from me to say to them or that I needed to hear. So essentially, this book is the result of writing in my journal every day for 3.5 months while I floated. Minimally, this has been my experience. Minimally, you have to stay at a I can't be prescriptive. I have to stay at a place for 5 days in order to enter the barometric pressure of that monastic order and that monastic personality. My experience, having made my first retreat as a senior at an all-boys Catholic Marianist school in Cleveland, Ohio, until 3 weeks ago, was that it takes 24 to 48 hours for something to happen. And the something to happen is the tough one. Psychologically, spiritually, emotionally, so that one enters that space. So other than that, I made no plans to have a beatific vision. That was supposed to be humorous, but maybe the beatific vision thing's a little tough. And I'm completely sympathetic to the fact that it is Friday evening. No revelation, no epiphany, The best advice I ever received was from a Trappist Cistercian monk at Gethsemane Monastery, where Thomas Merton spent pretty much his entire religious life. If you're coming here for salvation, we'd rather you go somewhere else. Maybe to the local pub in the town next to the monastery. If you're coming here to eat good food, take naps, and walk in the woods, come on. Yeah. The healthiest advice I ever received. So I put this book together writing from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. over a seven-month period. I wanted to write it, and I know what I'm about to say. I wanted to write it at that time where one is still a bit in dream state, one hasn't awakened, and so there's a porousness between the unconscious and the conscious, between the invisibles and the visible, however you want to frame it. And using my journal notes as the guide, I found that the book pretty much wrote itself. Yeah. Until I hit the reality of Josie Bass, who said, no one will buy and read a 230-page travel pilgrimage. Not in this day and age. So they said, you want to do the surgery, or shall we? So I took the manuscript to New Camaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur, where I began this pilgrimage. Slept with the manuscript for a night, and the next morning got up and pulled out the sections until it reduced itself in the fastest literary diet in the West to half its size, and that's what was published. But I'm fascinated with that process. But I'm more fascinated with, and I want to work this tomorrow, by using some of Joseph Campbell's journal entries from Bakshish and Brahman and Saki and Satori when he made that round-the-world pilgrimage, when he left Idlewild Airport in August of 1954 and returned in July of 1955. And on that pilgrimage, he discovered his life's work by journaling every day. So what I share, and I like these journals, which have just been published by New World Library in Novato, California, under the Campbell Foundation, under the leadership of Robert Walter. Their idea is they want to publish everything that Campbell has written, has never been published. When they're done, there will be 40 volumes. I mean, this guy gives Jung a run for his money, except now with this Philemond project, the collected works of Jung may be 50 volumes or more, the complete works, not the collected, of Jung. Here's Campbell, though, teaching three-quarters time to full-time at Sarah Lawrence College for 38 years, and still this output. And I learned the trick in the last pages of Saki and Satori, a technique that I started to use 2 years ago when he was in Kyoto, Japan, and he's preparing his syllabi for Sarah Lawrence for the fall. And he writes himself a note, begin taping all your classes. That's how he got the 38 to 40 books out. He took his notes and amplified them, and they became the essays, which then became the books. Yeah, it's an inexpensive technique, and so for the last 2.5 years, I've been taping everything, because my best, and I'm not alone here as a teacher. Oftentimes our best thinking takes place in the classroom. Then the class is over. The students may have some of it in their notes, but the rest of it's gone. So that's a technique that Campbell used as a way of remembering the way that he was working passages, teaching Joyce or Thomas Mann or some of his other favorites. What fascinates me now, having been distant from this book for a while, is as fascinating as what occurred to me in the process of writing, and that is that we fundamentally live our stories out by the quality of what is remembered. Yeah, by the quality of what is remembered. So I want to say it this way to you. It's like the plot of our lives consists of the events that we move through. But the action of our lives is the form that those events take in our memory. Now, this may be old news to you, but it's new. It was fairly new news to me. And that is this. The act of remembering is an act of the imagination itself. Now, I'm not speaking about the kind of memory that says, where did I leave my keys? I'm speaking about the kind of memory that begins to ask, now this is right out of Grace in the Desert, what the hell is my father doing appearing to me on a bench at a Carmelite monastery in Northern California after he's been dead for 18 months? Now there's a memory worth latching on to. Yeah. And Tom Moore picked it up in the preface. He says the heart of this book is the reconciliation of a son with an alcoholic father. That's it. Yeah. Now we're in a place where we're speaking about the relationship between what has been and what's destined to be. And you know who our paradigm or our archetype for that is? It's Oedipus. It's Oedipus. That play by Sophocles points out clearly that our destinies are behind us. They're not in front of us. I think we've gotten trapped in some linear sabotage. I think our destinies are what we remember. Yep. Now, I'm sharing with you some of the insights that have come to me as a result of this process. I'm also interested tomorrow, but also tonight, of entertaining with you. And one of the things I love about teaching adults is that they have an elongated history. God bless the undergrads. I taught them for 23 years. Oh, she's the one wearing the ears. Got it. Telly. Your name is Legion. I'm teasing her. Tell her I'm teasing. Here's a short poem by Rilke, entitled, and I know many of you know it, "Sometimes a man stands up during supper." Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And his children say blessings on him as if he were dead. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses. so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot. There it is. When I read that poem, I thought, God, Rilke, you hit it on the nail. Listen to it once more. Because Psyche, in her recursivity, will amplify the poem for you, now that you know the plot. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And his children say blessings on him as if he were dead. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses, so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot. Now, I remember reading something in Jung's volume on the symbolic life, and Jung is citing some event, and almost parenthetically he says, and this event, or this figure, I can't remember the detail, terrifies me as much as the thought of living a meaningless life. Jung carried that terror of a life without meaning. I think every one of us does. So that when that book fell on my foot, it was the first step, if you'll excuse a bad pun, of what Joseph Campbell says of the hero's journey is the recognition of a call. Second, accept the call or refuse it. This is the Rilke, this is the two men in Rilke's poem. Once one accepts the call, here's the tough part. Once one accepts the call, and he lays this out in Hero with a Thousand Faces, once one accepts the call, then one must be willing to enter the forest where it is thickest and alone, and where there's no path. So if you accept the call, then you must be willing to enter the forest, where not where it leans out, but where it thickens. And at least initially, like Dante in that first canto of Inferno, must be willing to get up and go it alone, but it has to be done where there's no other path. Because if you enter the path, you are on someone else's destiny, not yours. Yeah, that makes sense? So what I'm trying to get at for myself and ask you to think about it with me is how deeply mythic this pilgrimage was, which I can only see now. Stay with me. Not in the event of the journeying, which was filled with loneliness and just terrible stuff. I mean, it's underworld stuff. If you really take the pilgrimage on, take a deep breath, because you're going to be pulled into the underworld. And not in any Hallmark card sense of that underworld. Terrifying stuff. Let's see, I wanted to say that, and where did I want to go from that? To the underworld. To go it alone. Thank you, Mnemosyne. The Greeks were so smart in making memory a divine goddess. Yeah, Mnemosyne herself, without whom narratives can't even be. So first enter that wood of the journey itself. Then to write about it while one's in it. Second. Third. Frame, create, shape, give form to, with the aid of the memory of the journals, into some more complete narrative. Three. Let time go by and then read that narrative. Four. You see, and I want to suggest to you that each one of these is a form of pilgrimage. Yeah. Each one is a form of pilgrimage. So that the act of reading and remembering itself is a pilgrimage act. Yeah. One of the oldest archetypes, I think, in the psyche is the pilgrim. And one of the oldest, what Jung calls archetype of transformation, which he lays out in the towards the end of that first chapter, Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious, is an archetype, what does he say? An archetypal situation, which he says, this is an archetype of transformation. I want to suggest that the archetypal situation is the pilgrimage itself. Yeah. So it is both simultaneously something external as plot and something internal as action. As action. So here's the mystery for me. How is it that the reality of the external world that one moves through in its particularities is in some fantastic way a mere reflection of particles of the psyche that are set in motion internally? The Greeks had a term for it. They called it mimesis, which Aristotle gives us in the Poetics. That is, this is what Aristotle says. Well, I think he's one of the first depth psychologists in the West. So around 430, 440 BCE, he's writing about tragedy, but I think he's writing about poetry. But he's got Sophocles' Oedipus in his brain. And he says that there is something in us humans that loves to imitate. And of course, we see this full blown in a young child who will. And the imitation is part of repetition. So with a young child, you can play the same simplistic game and it's always new because something is being fed by the act of repetition itself. Which I think, then, as one develops, repetition becomes recursivity. You with me? See, there's something about psyche's movement that is fundamentally recursive. It wants to come back at it. And let me hear that again. And wait a minute, tell me again what happened. You didn't tell me that last Thursday. You left those pieces out. Now, somebody may be duplicitous or somebody may... or something in the psyche was not yet ready to give those pieces up. Now that seems to me, and if you'll just stay with me here, that seems that sense of the repetitive, the love of imitation, the love of repetition, which Aristotle says gives human beings joy, then develops into a recursivity. Come back at it. Come back at it. Not in a repetition compulsion, but no. It's not direct. Where's my? No, there's no board. All right. Stay with it. Imagine. Come back at it. But it doesn't touch. It just drops down a little bit. So it's coming back, resonating with the last circle or spiral. It's not a circle. This is really good because this is helping me say it out loud and think through it. Hold that. Paragraph 414, volume 9-2, Ion. Researches into the phenomenology of the self. Jung starts off with a dependent adverbial clause, which is the heartbeat of depth psychology from where I stand, and I want to tie it to this recursivity. Jung says, this is pretty close, since analogy formation is a law, now that's his language, which to a large extent governs the life of the psyche. Independent clause, which we don't need because he's referring to something in paragraph 413. Listen to it again, because I think it's the heartbeat of depth psychology. Since analogy formation is a law which to a large extent governs the life of the psyche. See, what he's saying is fundamentally the psyche is poetic. That fundamentally the psyche is analogical. And what are analogies? Well, they're ways of things resembling each other. And you come back at it and you say, well, it's like ALS-OB, right? ALS-OB. It's as if. When I read Jung, and anytime he uses that phrase, as if, he is saying, here comes the analogy. I can't speak about it directly, so I'm going to speak about it, as Emily Dickinson says. Emily Dickinson talks about speaking about the truth. She says, tell the truth, but tell it slant. Tell it slant. You see, come at it. None of this stuff. This is for plebeians, Republicans. No, I didn't say that. Put the foot down on the tape. Yeah, get that out of there. I mean, come at it slant. Come at it by indirection. No. So what I to come around, as I look at this book, it has shifted in its fixity and has become a witness to what I think was actually taking place in me. When I made that journey at age 54, I was passing out ritually, and I didn't know it. This is one of the crazy things about ritual. Can you be engaged in a ritual and not be conscious of it? I think so. I was ritualistically passing from adulthood into elderhood. And I only discovered that in hindsight. Are you with me? I mean, it's Oedipal. This is an Oedipal moment. One's destiny is behind one. Yeah. That's the genius of Sophocles' play. And I think it's in a large measure why Hillman puts the Oedipus figure at the very nub of therapy itself. Because to remember is to move forward. Yeah. The act of remembering is an act forward and back. Forward and back. Yeah. Yeah. So that has something really important to do with the nature of coming back at it. Coming back at it. Which for me is one of the great mysteries of writing itself. And that's part of what I want to explore tomorrow. The mystery inherent in the act of writing itself. Yeah. Can I share one thing here with you from Goethe? Yeah. This is another part of that archetype of the pilgrim and the pilgrimage. Goethe writes, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, follow this, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves to." This is so Joseph Campbell, but Goethe beat him. So this is, Campbell is so Goethean. "All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred." You got to take that in. I mean, I can stand here in a kind of Hamletian freeze frame. Can't move. Goethe is suggesting, and you all, I bet, know this, you move and the world responds. Yeah, I don't want to lock it in. It responds. Something in the anima mundi responds. "All sorts of things occur to help one that would have never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision." Listen to that. A whole stream of events issues from your decision to make a move. "Raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would have come his way." Yeah, I just think there's a whole philosophy of being in about four sentences. Yeah. Here's Ahab, Moby Dick, Porter Dick. You didn't think I'd get through this talk without quoting Moby Dick. Oh, that white whale. Ooh. Ahab says, and he's alone. And he's calling on St. Paul. He says, "To my restless breezes, give calm." And then he says, "O nature and O soul of man." I may have to fudge here. "O nature and O soul of man, however matched are your linked analogies, such that nothing exists in the outer world that does not have a cunning little duplicate in mind." This from Ahab. See, "O nature and O soul of man, how," and I can't get that word, "are your linked analogies such that nothing exists in the created order, in the world, in the universe, that does not have, I love this phrase, a cunning little duplicate in mind. Yeah. Isn't that gorgeous? So psyche moves. You make the move. Hillman's favorite word. His most unfavorite word is transformation. Sorry. Ranked right up there with wholeness. Oop, another wound. He says, but no, psyche makes a move. He says, watch psyche's move. Watch the move she makes. Yeah. So this is Goethe. Psyche makes a move. And then the entire world responds. And it sounds like, benevolently, that from Goethe's vantage point, if I'm reading him with any accuracy, that there's something fundamentally benevolent in his worldview. It doesn't mean that there is not going to be wounds, suffering. I don't think he's a sentimentalist. But there's some movement in providence itself that gives a response of encouragement. Yeah, that's how I want to say it. That gives a response of encouragement to suggest something here is on the right track. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So can I, check in? 8:20, good. Now, may I share a little bit of writing with you? Yeah. Four of you nodded. This is not a good thing. This is not good. All right. Will you four please come to the front here? I want to just share a couple of pieces because, and if you join me and you join the others tomorrow, you know, we're going to work with things like metaphor. Whether you want to read aloud what you write, that's your call. There's no obligation to. In fact, I'd like to do at least one exercise with you tomorrow, where you write something particularly and poignantly private that you have never put into words, which I will ask no one to read, because I want you. And if, I know you've had this, but there's something about doing these things in public, where you don't read in public, but you are engaged in a public experience, where just the language, the words, the sentence structure, the image itself carries its own energy that I really believe is healing. Because I've written about it, I can say it now. That and up until I was in my mid-50s, I could not let it be known that I grew up with my three brothers and sister in a raging, destructive, alcoholic household. The shame was too great. If I had written this book and it was never published, it would have been okay. Because languaging a wound that we all carried through adulthood was enough reward in and of itself. Yeah. In other words, just the act of writing it out was sufficient. Yeah. And 2 weeks ago at a faculty senate meeting, where three of us presented some things on language, I said for the first time in my life publicly about my father's destructive behavior, first time publicly at age 60. That's how deep the wound was. I think the first thing that happened was writing about it. Then the speaking had an opportunity to come forward. Yeah. So I want to just share with you a couple of pieces. Because I became fascinated with the writing itself in the way that it's structured. See, this is what I'm trying to get at through Campbell's understanding of myth. The metaphors we use, because, see, I believe that psyche not only inhabits words, psyche inhabits sentences, and psyche inhabits punctuation. In other words, I think there's psyche in semicolons. I think there's psyche in dashes and hyphens. See, they carry these rhetorical pieces carry energy. And this is what poets know both intuitively and formally. You align the words correctly, and you're going to tap into something that cannot, perhaps, be expressed without that particular conjunction, juxtaposition of words. Yeah. So another thing I'd like to do tomorrow is try our hand at writing poetry, short, by looking at two poems as springboards. Yeah. Now, how many are coming? No, don't. Order that I never knew existed there. And I've camped and been out most of my young life and adult life. How do I want to say it to you? Some format gets exposed depending on the attitude of openness that one is willing to offer. Now, it seems obvious, but, you know, there's obvious and then there's obvious. So engaging a pilgrimage, which may or may not have anything to do with monasteries, I want to make that really clear. I'm not saying, get thee to a monastery. Yeah. You know that line. But what I do want to say is there is a way of the way that energy is concentrated in a monastery that allows that opening to occur with more facility. Yeah, yeah. I like that. Did you take that down? You don't have to. We're taping to engage with greater facility that opening. Yeah. And part of it has to do with adopting. Now, I'm speaking for me, not for you. Part of it has to do with adopting an ascetic disposition. Yeah. I carried everything for 3.5 months that would fit in the back of a Ford Ranger pickup. And you know what? About a third of the way into the trip, I realized I had twice as much crap as I needed. And I started leaving stuff. You know, there's something about that ascetic, where things get stripped down, they get stripped away, and then something opens up. So let me share with you just a couple of pieces here. I think you'd enjoy this. 37. I'm going to skip a few of those. This was at a Zen monastery, 37. Let's see. Yeah, this is Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. I've never been to a Zen retreat or monastery in my life. And this was one of those the fourth moment in Campbell's hero's journey. Once you enter the woods, no path, alone, the next move, and this is often overlooked because of so much language around the egoic hero, which is very different from the hero of Campbell. He says that a fourth step is the willingness to yield oneself to something greater than who one is. Whatever that is, whatever it is. But it's not that charge of the ego. In fact, it really is a move, I think, to asceticism. So, I just share this with you. Except for, I think, three monasteries which were populated, all the others, I found myself the only retreatant there. So, really, God really worked me over with regard to loneliness. Not being alone, but loneliness. What an opening loneliness creates. So, I'm in this cabin by myself, and I'm going to read. I set the small alarm clock in my room for 4 a.m. It seemed to jar me from sleep almost as soon as I lay down. I showered and dressed in the empty house, once again the only retreatant staying in this particular refuge. I waited for the bancho bell that would ring across the expansive field and garden to call me to the zendo for zazen. And you know that that is the meditation prayer. This was all, the language was new to me, the whole thing was new to me. Which is so rich in retrospect, because one never has one's bearings. It's all new, all the time. I shouldn't say one, I should say I. The day began in an enveloping dark calmness, which is my favorite time of the day. The roosters across the road at the farmhouse had not yet stirred into their morning shrieks. I tidied up my room and then entered the living room to read for a half an hour in the comfort of the old sofa. As I sat on the couch, my eye caught some movement in the kitchen next to the stove. It moved as quickly as a thought or a shadow might appear, and disappeared as I looked up and sat quietly. In a moment, a mouse darted out from under the stove and scurried a foot or two to a box of rodent poison sitting between the stove and the refrigerator. He stuck his little gray head in and ate a mouthful or two. The story's going to end happily. Hang on. Then, as if he suddenly realized he was on display, he snapped his head out of the opening in the poison food container, scattering the little pellets across the floor as he scooted under the stove. He then peered out and up from under the stove with his ears flapped completely open and pointing forward like Japanese fans. He looked directly at me, then scampered under the stove. After a moment, he scurried out again over to the box of poison food and began eating again, repeating the entire escapade. Then the bell rang to call us to meditation. So I left him and then moved into, moved into the zendo. And as soon as we all became seated and quiet, for an hour and a half of meditation, and I tried with my little ability to clear my mind. That mouse appeared like a god and would not let me go. Now, the reason I'm bringing up animals, the reason I decided to bring up animals tonight is that Jim Hillman came to my Joseph Campbell tracks, two tracks, one Monday night and one 3 weeks ago. And if you know his work, he has been collecting animals in dreams since 1963, 1964, and began working Joe Campbell's The Way of the Animal Powers to point out how powerfully, not numinous necessarily, although that's part of it as well, but how divine animals are. And when he said that, just this past Monday, I began to think, is that what these animals were doing in these monasteries? Is that the way? And it's a question, not an affirmation. Is that the way divinity kept appearing to me? Yeah. And Hillman is very clear about the fact that the animal does not represent a divinity. The animal itself is divine. Spiders, gnats, whales, bulls. Size seems irrelevant. When he said that in class, it sent me back to the book and remembering how constant animals were in the entire pilgrimage. What did it do? It gave me another way of seeing what I had written. You see that? So where is the larger question here with regard to personal myth and meaning is, where does the meaning lie and how does it get in? I think it gets in by analogy, and I think it gets in by recollection. Yeah. So push it one step further. Analogy is a way of remembering. Yeah. That the psyche moves analogically in part because it is always in the act of recollection. Yeah. So I want you to hear me when I say, I wrote it, but I didn't get it. Well, wait, if you wrote it, you must know what it means. Not so. Yeah. I didn't have the right analogy. You with me here? To see by. I didn't have the right analogy by which to see. Yeah. And that, ladies and gentlemen, I think is what myths are. They are ways of seeing. They're not about content. Yes, they are. I can't get absolute. They are as much about angle of vision as they are about content. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the former is more important than the latter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let me... I want to share this with you. Let me see. Hang on. Yeah, we're good. A few more minutes. Are you warm? Yeah, it's warm. I'm warm up here, and I know that you must be. I wonder if the door were open, and Shirley, maybe just a little bit of a draft coming through. I think I lost two people in the back. No names, please. Yeah. This is Our Lady of Trinity Trappist Monastery, south of Portland. No. Get it right. Huntsville, Utah. Yeah. East of Salt Lake City by about 40 miles. Yeah. After Mass, thank you, much better. After Mass and light breakfast, I dressed warmly and slogged out in the snow to hang onto the barbed wire and mourn with them. I'm trying to get to the second piece, but I woke up one morning to hear 50 or 60 cows lowing and moaning, and asked the monks, what's going on? And they said, well, yesterday we took their babies from them and put them in a pasture about a quarter mile away. So here all of these mothers are crying for their babies. And it went on for 2.5 days. All night, all day. I'm just going to catch the back end of this. But this herd of cows made us all feel the acute sense of loss that life never tired of presenting to each of us. The calves, meanwhile, penned in several acres across the road and against the other mountain range that framed this grief-stricken valley, echoed in their voices the cry of their mothers in the darkness. Grief felt deeply was such a solitary act, it seemed to defy sharing. But it could be heard and felt wherever loss created a wound and left dark acres of ache in the terrain we tread within us. Now here's the transition. Darkness and silence. These two experiences had taken deep root in me as God's way of being most present. God's dark world was working itself deep within me. The less I did, the better. I walked in the morning before Mass and breakfast amid the cloak of deep silence that covered the natural order. The cows were now all in the barn, resigned and silent, completely exhausted after 3 full days of grieving. 3 days. Silence now reclaimed the land and the monastery to absorb all the grief of another year's ritual separation of mother and children, another give-and-take pattern of life. As the dawn began its subtle shading from darkness into a pallid light, I hiked up a large hill close to the monastery. I could hear animals rustling in the thick bush. Then all became silent, and this silence wanted to be heard. I looked down as I hiked and saw something of a different color, which made it stand out against the green shrubs. I picked up the lower hind leg of a small deer. All the skin still clung persistently to the meager flesh, soft and hard against the bone, like a very thin but elegant carpet without padding. Its black and glossy split hoof was still intact, smooth to the touch, elegant in shape. The leg had been gnawed off, perhaps by coyotes or wolves. I doubted that the leg had been detached for long, Its tan and white hide was still fresh, clean, and alive. I fingered the dainty split hoof, so thin and elegant, too thin, I thought, to support the weight of such a large animal. The smell of it was of a live rather than decaying thing, gamey and musky. I placed it by a rock and sat down beside it. Later that day, I would read in Merton's Thoughts in Solitude, quote, "There are few who are willing to belong completely to such silence, to let it sink into their bones, to breathe nothing but silence, to feed on silence, and to turn the very substance of their life into a living and vigilant silence." Hard words, an implicit challenge. If God called each of us to Him in and through something we were attracted to, then He calls me through silence. I turn my attention back to the gnawed leg of the deer. What was so fascinating and frightening about this deer's dismemberment? The rest of the animal had surely been eaten so that others lived. Parentheses. After over two decades of studying world mythologies, Campbell came to some fundamental tenets shared by all. Every people with a mythology shared some fundamental properties. And one of them was and is life feeds on life. Every culture around the world that's embedded in their mythology. And then he had others, but that right here, and every culture with that came to it by watching the natural order. Yeah. The rest of the animal had surely been eaten so that others lived. The leg then was a remembrance. In its severed state, it revealed both life and death in one appendage. And then my fantasy. What would it be like to wear it? To drill a hole through its bone and loop it from a chain around my neck, to carry something of the animal's spirit against my chest. The sheer shininess of the black hoof looked as if it had been buffed by hand with a soft oil rag. I felt a reluctance to leave it, but I dropped it back to the earth. The leg, now this is in remembrance. This didn't happen there, what I'm going to say right now. The leg had a mythic quality to it, some magic, like a talisman. Now, in the experience, it wouldn't let me go. And if I can say it most directly, it wanted to be an adornment. But I didn't understand that desire of the leg to be an adornment was the mythic quality of the animal wanting to be heard, felt, seen, touched. No. Only in remembrance, this is the key. I think, it's my conviction, that mythologies grow out of the memory. Because in the memory, as I understand it, it's such a complicated thing, this whole business of remembering. But in the memory, like in the psyche, or the remembering psyche, can I say it that way? is an organizing principle. There's an organizing principle. And what does it organize? I think it organizes disparate pieces and bits into a coherent story. Yeah. Into a coherent story. You know, it's so interesting to study the figure of Mnemosyne, the goddess memory, who lies seven nights with Zeus, which is consciousness itself. I mean, one read. And gives birth to the nine muses, one after another. And in addition to that, we don't know a whole lot about her. But for the Greeks, and I said it earlier and I want to say it again, she is the impulse to narrative itself. So that because of memory, stories are even possible. Which makes the diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's so insidious because they take away a person's story. And without our narrative, our identity is either completely occluded or so vague or so piecemeal that we lose the coherence. Yeah. That's the terrible. And you who have parents suffering from those, as my mother did, you can name others. But what we found so heartbreaking about our mother, who passed away December 1 of last year, is that she had no story anymore to share, which is to say she had lost her history. And it became so clear to us, her children, how our identity is absolutely reflected in the quality and the quantity of the narrative we can recollect. Our own. Yeah. And by extension, the larger family. Yeah. Yeah. So the mythic quality of that experience, the one I just read, revealed itself only in recollection. Yeah. That's where I think myths are born, out of mnemosyne, out of memory. Yeah. Which is why memory itself is, if you'll allow me to come back, memory itself is what allows that recursivity of psyche, its motion, its energy for that motion. Yeah. It's cyclic. It's not cyclical. It's, if you'll allow this clumsy adjective, it's spiralic. It's spiralic. Don't ask me to spell it. Would you spell it? No, don't. You have to tell. It's spiralic. It comes back as spiral. As spiral. And it's interesting to look at Dante's Commedia because the movement of the first 34 cantos of Inferno are from the large with Dis, with Satan frozen in ice at the bottom. Then the inverse mirror reflection, Purgatorio, 33 cantos, wide at the base, wide, up, smaller. Yeah. So I think Dante in that poem of 1310, 1312 gives us the movement of psyche as depth psychology grasps it. Yeah, he gave us the structure by how psyche moves, both in recognition of violation, pathos, pathology, and in the way that psyche purges itself from that pathos. Yeah. Now it's ready for that movement up almost straight through the planets, up through the cosmos to paradise. And I think Dante gives it to us. Yeah. And when you go to the Index of Jung and look up Dante, look up Divine Comedy, look up Beatrice, you will be astonished at the number of references in the collective works in which Dante, in which Jung returns again and again to that poem. Yeah. All right, let's see where we are. Ooh, 10 till. Time? Break? 10 minutes? How long? How, my advisor? Let's take... What would you like to bring up? What would you? What observation would you like to make? Yeah. Explain psyche. I just write about it. I'll explain psyche. Grace in the desert. Take a look.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was trying to get to speak in writing the book. To get out of the way of one venue for psyche to have voice and to make porous, your question's a fair one, and to make porous that demarcation between what's visible and what's invisible, what's unconscious and what's conscious. And I think that's, for me, what pilgrimages, not tourism, allow for. Yeah. Yeah. Which is part of why I wrote it when I did, 4 to 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how you all work, but I get up at 4:15 7 days a week. By 9 o'clock, the day's done. I don't have much use for the rest of it. So I go over to Pacifica and make a living. Except days where I teach, because the teaching is too, it's too good. I mean, it's too great. But, yeah, I mean, if that's, that's where the muses visit me. Remember Flannery O'Connor, who died at the age of 39 from lupus? Every morning she writes in Habit of Being, when my disease allowed me, I was at my desk, because if I wasn't, I ran the risk of missing the muses if they showed up and I wasn't there. So it's that sense of a discipline. Yeah, it's a sense of a discipline. And that's where psyche, if I'm going to write any poetry, if I'm going to read poetry, it has to happen before 7:30 in the morning. Yeah. I just think it's so important for every one of us to learn when, if not where, psyche is most probable to visit us. It's so important, I think. And I, you know, in the classroom, we talk about that too, especially with regard to dissertation writing, you know, to find that time and keep disciplined and showing up for it. Yeah. What about what I was suggesting about the way that memory is, if not mythic itself, opens corridors to realities that might best be called mythic? See, Campbell writes again and again, metaphor is the native tongue of myth. Metaphor is the native tongue of myth. myths speak metaphorically about what can't be grasped directly. You know, it can't be logosed.
Connie.
Yikes.
The essay. Well, the essay is taking place in analysis. They're no longer just analysis because it's seen as a type of cultural material.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of what you think of the essay, because I don't really think they should be given it all anywhere, but in the way that they carried out. Nevertheless, it shows you that there's some serious value shift in the place.
Yes.
Very serious because you can, you know, the questions that they ask of those, you know, that type of thing.
Yes.
What is happening in terms of education of the children in terms of making sure that, you know, they aren't simply in mind training and
Absolutely. So that piece has been dropped. I didn't know that. It's so funny to have that drop, but the essay come in.
Yeah, but which, I don't bother to know what kind of, I mean, the essay itself is what? I mean, it's
so very brief and.
Well, they have three pages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so techne stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, that goes out. Please. You know, in that Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious chapter, volume 9-1, Jung has been describing the anima, the wise old man, and then a third, might be the shadow. And then about 2.5 pages before the end of that chapter, he says, but you know, there is another category of archetypes, which I want to call archetypes of transformation. And they consist of three categories. Situations, one. Condition, two. And then a very curious phrase, ways and means. I think pilgrimage is an archetypal situation. It could also be an archetypal condition, which is, for Jung, a mode of transformation. So I go to him to help me understand that ancient movement of psyche. Let me add one other thing, if this might be helpful. There are two kinds of pilgrimages, two kinds of pilgrims. One kind of pilgrimage is to or towards a site, a goal, a destination. a sacred place, a sacred shrine, a sacred origin of a river, in Ireland, a sacred well. And then the other kind of pilgrimage, and there's a term for it, and I think it's in my notes, I don't think I want to go look for it, is that peregrinatio, that wanderer. It's a kind of traveling without a set destination. Huh? It would be very good. That would be an analogy, a walkabout. And you are open to having the world kind of help you, I mean, to be fed and a place of shelter. There's a term for it. It's something like a wanderer in the service of Christ. And there's a Latin phrase for it. So those two different kinds of situations, both of which are hugely transformational. Does that help a little bit? Oh, Shirley, I'm sorry. Yes, it does. Thank you. I just found it. And Shirley, you gave me the few seconds I needed, as well as making a good point. The Sanskrit word, that's how old it is. The Sanskrit word for pilgrimage. If you're interested, I'll spell it for you. I'm not even sure I get it pronounced right. It looks like pravrajya. P-R-A-V-R-A-J-Y-A, which means a going forth. I'm reading from my notes. It is the same term for admission or ordination to the first grade of Buddhist monkhood. Then, surely, peregrinatio, a wandering, and the one who wanders is a peregrinus, a stranger. And that ties into your notion of exile. P-E-R-E-G-R-I-N-U-S. Yeah. Yeah. And for me, the thickest, most complicated paradigm for this human behavior is Dante's Commedia, which is a 100 canto, I don't know, what is it, 14,000 and something lines, this will be visual aid, I can't use the board, in terza rima rhyme scheme. Now, why this is so important has everything to do this notion of stepping into the world and retrieving something in this canto, in this dance. So if, let's see if the memory's working at all. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, first line. Mi ritrovoi per una selva oscura. And the first line ends vita. We give it an A. Second line ends in oscura. We give it a B. Che la darita via era smarita. Ooh, smarita rhymes with vita. We give it an A. You with me? First three lines. In the middle of this journey of our life, I found myself lost in a dark wood. For I had wandered from the path that does not stray. See, the path doesn't stray, but I did. So what do we have? Oh, God, listen, let me give myself a little compliment to even remember those lines. So, vita A, oscura B, smarita A, right? ABA, so visual. Now, it's a journey, it's a pilgrimage. So I'm on A, B, A. Now, that's a terza rima. That's three lines, right? Now, I wish I had a board. That's okay. You can follow me. A, B, A. Now, the middle term, B, becomes the first and third term of the second terza rima. So what do we have? A, B, A. B, C, B. Right? Third terza rima. C, D, C. You with me? Now watch what it looks like. Let's start over. A, B. Break my neck. A. B, C, B. C, D, C. 14,000 lines. He never misses a beat. So when he gets to Z is my middle term. Z, A, Z. Well, this is going to work. A, B, A, and we start over. I mean, just the structure is a tour de force. But you see what it grabs? You see psychologically what is grabbed? The way forward is the way back. The way back is the way forward. Now, how Heraclitean can you get? How depth psychological can you get? The terza rima is a depth psychological movement of psyche. Yeah. It is the poem, I think, for capturing this archetype of the pilgrimage. Nice. The poem suggests, in order A, B. Now right here, that was forward motion. But it cannot go any further until it retrieves what it has already stepped through. Yeah. So what is Dante doing? In this rhyme scheme, which we as readers become pilgrims, where the path is the written word, in a rhyme scheme that keeps us in the same tempo of the pilgrimage as the content keeps Dante, the pilgrim, moving forward and backward. But so we as readers are mirroring and imitating the pilgrimage that is the content that he is recollecting. Absolutely.
So you do A and then B, and then you come back to A and relax and deal with B. And then you move to B, C, and then you come back and deal with C.
Good.
So it's story. It's understanding.
Right.
It's having a time to see what B was like before you go to B and then go out of B to C.
Yes. Yes.
Which is what I was going to ask before, because you talked a lot about story. And I remember hearing Sam Keen talking about one time that he was saying that the sad thing in life is that a lot of people don't have people to tell their stories.
Beautiful. Right, we're capturing etymology, history, memory, a word we use may track back to the French, to the Latin, to the Greek, even to Sanskrit. So I want to say that psyche is at least as alive in the act of writing as she is in any other endeavor. And I think that's where the memory is. I mean, if we can't remember words, something of our identity disappears, which is part of the crisis of a culture existing in a continually diminishing vocabulary, where things like subtlety and nuance disappear from human expression. Those very things that psyche feeds off of, nuance, shading, subtlety, when those go, there's something barbaric in the speech. I think we lose psyche when we lose vocabulary. Yep. And, you know, when it kind of bark at students a little bit, hey, you know, lighten up, subject, verb, object, subject, verb, object. Give it a rest. Surprise us all with a complex sentence. Sorry, I will now step off the soapbox, which is right here. But psychologically, it's so important to vary sentence structure. Because psyche gets flatlined with that same monotone, you know, like Campbell says, in a minute, Campbell says, and then I'm sleeping or reaching for the vodka. Shouldn't be on tape. Yeah. It's terribly psychological, this whole business of the way. So just to go back, the sophistication of Dante's structure is to show psyche continually retrieving its future and moving forward into her past. See, so this whole linear thing breaks down with the poetics. It just breaks down. I think it's a fib to begin with. Anyhow, in the back. Sorry. How many? How much did she pay to come in? No, I'm teasing. Go ahead. All right. Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, that wonderful collection of poems by Bly, Hillman, and Mead. And I can tell... that was your second question. You're done for the night. Next. No. let's see. It's right across from Throw Yourself Like Seed by Unamuno, 234. I think page 235. I use that Throw Yourself Like Seed. I was going to bring it tonight and hand it out to you, but then I decided to do something else. Now, this is three. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, it's it. See, I think it's it. I think it's the poetically embodied expression of just that. Yeah. That's why, to teach the Divine Comedy in a myth or depth program at Pacifica, it is just so right on. As soon as we can get over the hump that Dante is not writing theology, he's writing poetry, but he's using the prevailing myth of the 14th century, which was the Catholic Church in Western Europe. No way around that. But he's using it, I think, to show us something much more. Yeah, like Faulkner uses the South because it's what he knows. But is he writing about Southerners only? Well, hell no. But is he writing about Southerners? Hell yes. Yeah. So that's always a little bit of a stumbling block, but I don't find it to be a big stumbling. the worst students I ever taught the Divine Comedy to were a group of Dominican novitiates at the University of Dallas, going around in their black skirts and fluffing them around and saying, St. Thomas, this is not Thomistic. They would not let the poem be a poem. It had to match some absolute theological truth or dogma. Yeah, so it was, Dante's a heretic. No, Dante's a poet. They wouldn't let it go. Anyhow, that's the past, and I feel much better having shared that with you. Jim? Yes. Beautiful. Yes. Yes. Say that again, that last part on Beyond.
This is the Beyond. These people say we're so violent to ourselves, we don't live into our destiny, we don't live into our myth, because we can't get there. We're out of rhythm. We've lost a basic rhythm.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's Wordsworth's world is too much with us. Yeah.
But I'm thinking.
Yes, good.
My experience of my Divine Comedy seems to be so sore right now as a wounding in the culture. We've become so technological. We've lost, where is memory? Where is that poesis, that poetic slant?
Yeah, that Emily Dickinson gives us. Yes. Yeah. There's something connected with literalism that is not slant, prone. Yeah, because slant is analogical, slant is metaphoric, which has a precision to it, even beyond literalism. Yeah, even beyond a literal understanding of something.
When you told the story of the cow, I actually thought you weren't seeing something new, you were remembering.
Yeah.
A very poetic moment.
Yes.
And for some reason I thought of that great novel about Calvino, Mr. Palomar. I don't know if you remember that. It's an incredible journey to the very things of what do we know, where am I, what am I up to?
Okay.
Very depth psychological as well.
Yes.
Anyway, I don't really have any more points.
No, it's fine. I appreciate it. Both of those observations, Jim, thank you. And of course, the, Plato's The Meno, that dialogue is about, it's the best dialogue on education. Well, so many of Plato's dialogues are about education, but it is about getting someone who seems to know little to nothing to pose the right question to him so he remembers everything. Which is a maieutic way of learning. You know, you pose the right question, and suddenly something I didn't even know I knew bubbles forth. Which gives this is Plato's notion that maybe all the forms are in us waiting to come out. But like Percival with the king, the wounded king, they have to wait for Kairos, that right time, and then to pose the right question within that right time. And so Percival's education is, a coming to a place to pose the correct question, not to make the correct assertion, but to ask the right question. Then the king can be healed. What a wonderful medieval story about the connection between being wounded and healing, and being able to pose the right question that begins the healing process. Yeah, terrific. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in a time warp here. Okay, please. Yes. Yes. Nice. Yes. Oh, good. No, it's really good what he spotted that I didn't know until he said it. Would you, because I don't know if they heard you back there. Would you repeat? It's really a...
The three examples of animals with wounded animals. And my question was, what was Dennis remembering?
Yeah. Yeah, that's terrific. See, I didn't see that. I'm going to answer off the cuff here, but off the cuff maybe gets at it. Yeah, he pointed out that the three examples of animals were all wounded or dismembered or maimed in some way. What might I have been seeing by analogy or thinking about or remembering? There is no question in my mind now that the main reason for that pilgrimage was to heal a rift between me and my now deceased father. And you know what it showed me? It didn't matter whether he was alive or dead. That was an irrelevant issue. You know what I'm saying. Yeah, so thank you for that, because I think that was the ethos I was traveling inside of, woundedness itself. That was my myth. And to go back to what I said earlier, again, the myth is a way to see something. I think that's more important. I'm leaning on that. I think it's more important than the content seen. Again, not to separate out or trash one or but I just want to emphasize that other side. You've been a wonderful and accepting and open audience, and I want to thank you all. And I want to hope that maybe I see some of you tomorrow. Salute. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.